Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
I'm prepared to do anything I can to play my country again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Should have sort of social life out here.
Watch your language again, Kevin. We've already had complaints about it this evening.
Yeah, no,
you're losing the run of yourself.
I don't recall that as well. I don't recall that other.
You're still getting the ire of the listeners.
Oh man, they're not happy.
No, they're not happy. Sadio Mane, multi-millionaire footballer, should give the ball to the ball boy and let him go home and be happy.
So what was it?
What, like, were you the type? So after every Liverpool game, Mo Salah goes over to the crowd and hands a kid his jersey. It's a lovely thing to do. Like, you never did that when you were a player? Oh no, I might need this as a memento in 20 years' time.
No.
Yeah, you know, somebody come around the house and be showing off my Wigan jersey against Queen's Park Rangers.
What a knob,
honest to God. Seriously, now that deserves it. You deserve it like that sometimes, honest to God.
I'm just saying.
No, I would have given loads of stuff away over the years, loads and loads of stuff, but I wouldn't necessarily be the sort of lad that would like to take it off on the pitch and then go and give it into the crowd. I personally think that's all for show, so I wouldn't be doing that. Yeah, I do, yeah. I just think, yeah, there's loads of times you'll be leaving games and, you know, the odd pair of boots, shirts, training gear, whatever it would be. Certainly would have been plenty of opportunities to give kit to supporters. Yeah, and everyone would do it, yeah. I just don't necessarily see it as a big thing, taking your shirt off, running up to the crowd, giving it, and then, it's not for me.
Having that pal.
No.
Did you ever score a hat-trick?
No, in a word. A couple of braces, I think, in my time, and that was about it.
Even at underage level?
Oh, quite underage level, yeah, yeah. Many underrated.
Patrick would be conservative, I'd say. The odd weekend around Preston. Yeah.
So Dan McDonald has joined us. How are you?
Yeah, good.
Oh, it's Christmas Eve for you, is it?
Oh yeah, I love when the League of Ireland comes back. It does. Yeah, get the Friday nights.
You don't sound very sincere there.
I know I do. Yeah. I absolutely, genuinely do. I think, you know, there's not a huge amount of people out there feeling that way, but those that do, the Friday nights in the winter, they drag because it's a long off season. It's not like the Premier League where it's almost, you know, if you have a major tournament somewhere, it's almost like 5 weeks or something, and it's right back. I mean, this is probably the last Friday night round of fixtures would have been the end of October. It's actually earlier this year. I mean, that's a good thing because they've gone to a 10-team league, so it's 36 games. So we now start in the middle of February. I mean, a couple of years back, it was the first weekend in March. So like, that's a long off season. And you speak to players and people involved, it would drive them absolutely crazy just to wait for it. So it's good to have it back.
Have you done the pod this week?
Give
you
a bit of a plug, we did. Myself and Johnny did our podcast this week.
We have our own podcast.
Yeah. I know there's an off-the-ball one as well. All very good. We had Jared Bryan.
Game, isn't it?
We had Jared Bryan and Aaron who was in with Keith Andrews last week. You see that? A bit of cross-code.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call that cross-code. It would be that seeing that somebody who's really good and off the ball and then nicking them for your own.
And we had him on last year a couple of times, to be fair. So we did. We had a lengthy preview. And there is a lot of people doing their stuff, and I think, you know, in the, you know, the sort of the way media is now, that the podcast market has probably worked quite well, I think, for the league, because it services a sort of an audience that's really passionate about it and want to sort of get as much as they can this week. And I think there is a good buzz around the season. Maybe people say that every year, but it feels a bit more sincere.
Yeah. Like other leagues, we don't have to ask what sort of state the league is in at the start of the season. Are we past having to ask that about the League of Ireland?
Not quite getting, you know, it's still a question. You know, when, I mean, Bray Wanderers stuff happened last year, but it is true that the debates we have are always, like, you go to talk about the League of Ireland and it's always a bigger picture debate of, well, where are things going? There's never a sense of you fully debate the football and where things are now. You want to aspire towards that, but I think there's imperfections there that you want to get rid of, but so you can genuinely have that discussion. But I mean, there are good things going on. I mean, I did watch the Keith Andrews show earlier with Kevin Doyle speaking about underage leagues and so on, and That's a we've spoken about on the show before, but at least it's something that's new that's going on at the moment. You know, for the last 30, 40 years, you can have a lot of recurring debates. But I think what we are seeing now is the personality of the league is changing slightly. It's becoming a much younger league. What we would have seen last year after a slow couple of years maybe would have been, you know, 7, 8, 9 players going away from first team clubs to England, you know, with the Sean Maguire and, you know, Kevin O'Connor, and even the guys in the off season, McMillan, McElhenney, and even younger guys, Warren O'Hara from Bowes, who's gone to Brighton. And the challenge is to almost regenerate that. If you lose, you know, 5 or 6 years back, there was a talent drain and there wasn't players there to replace them. You would hope with the leagues and the national leagues now that...
Do you feel there is? Because okay. I look at the teams for the President's Cup last week, and to be honest, I didn't recognise a huge amount of the names in the Dundalk team.
Yeah, well, they've changed their squad over the winter, and they've actually maybe gone outside for a couple of players. But also this week, they've gone the route of bringing a few lads home. I mean, Daniel Cleary from Liverpool and Birmingham, like he went to Liverpool as a kid, was around a couple of Europa League squads. I think we might have talked about him here a couple of times. Mm. Didn't just quite get there. He's come home. There's a guy, Sam Byrne at Everton, whose brother is the rugby player, Adam, and he's signing on loan as well. They've had to look outside the league to strengthen a bit. But I just think at the likes of Bowes and some other clubs, you know, Shamrock Rovers very naturally as well, with some exciting young players they have there, that I'm happy with the league's personality being that. The league I went to when I was a kid was sort of the old part-time lads, and there was a romance about some of it, you know, Patsy Frayne having a smoke on the bench and all that type of thing after he was subbed off. And I think, but you have to naturally evolve and move beyond that. And if people can see it as the place where you'll see the next Sean Maguire or the next whoever it might be, and I think with the way things are at the national team at the moment anyway, there's a recognition that the League of Ireland is more important than it's ever been in the Irish football landscape. I think that's something that can at least change the script a small bit.
Yeah, sorry, John Caulfield's been quite critical of the coverage as well. Is that an argument that you could level? Do you see that? Because speaking to people over the last couple of days, that some would feel that there's more games being shown than ever, but John Caulfield himself feels as though there should be a game a week. Is that right? Around the coverage of the President's Cup game last week.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sold on the game a week thing myself. But I think his argument about moving games to Thursday nights for live TV, I'm completely in favour of that concept. I mean, it is natural enough. I mean, the figures aren't fantastic for Friday night games. But you know, there's a good chunk of the audience that would sit down and watch it are out at games themselves on a Friday night. And I like the idea of the Thursday night game and making it a bit of an event and a fixture. And there will be weeks where there's clashes, there'll be Europa League clashes and so on, but there's actually not too many of them across the season. And I mean, the Europa League is sort of denigrated many times, and then all of a sudden in the context of the Thursday night League of Ireland debate, it's like, oh, the Europa League is going to be on. So
Cork, though, are the best supported team in the league.
Yeah.
Like, they're in this bizarre situation, League of Ireland clubs, and maybe it is the only league in the world where clubs arguably lose money by having their game on television.
Yeah, this has been the problem. But I would think that's something that should be tackled. If you make the game enough of an event, that shouldn't be an issue. And in fact, I would have banged that drum a few times before myself. And sometimes games you feel are being picked just to meet your quota. And I mean, it's an unglamorous game. And I think the casual fans, who it gives them a reason not to go. However, like the big games that have been on TV, you think of the Cork Dundalk games and so on, they haven't been affected in any way by crowd on the gate whatsoever. Bowes Rovers wouldn't be affected by it. It's just sometimes the TV games there. I think he also made a very good point about, you know, they're stacked. There'd be 6 or 7 games in the next couple of weeks, then there'd be 6 weeks without it. So if you're trying to build up a regular audience, and then it goes for a month or 6 weeks. So I think there's a way to be more consistent and devise a plan rather than just a scattergun policy.
Are clubs doing enough to get people in? So we had Kieran Donaghy on in the past hour, and what they've done down in Tralee with the basketball is pretty remarkable, considering there was no club 2 years ago, and now they're getting up in 1,000 people every Saturday night because they've made it, well, basically almost a mini NBA. They've looked at what the NBA do in terms of entertainment and taken and done a budget version of that. But it's a family night out, everyone goes, everyone has a good time, and in some ways the result is irrelevant. It feels as though that the
would you,
League
would
of
you
Ireland
want that to go
still,
all glam like that, or would you want that?
See, I think there is a halfway house that you don't want it to be so cultish that unless you're all in on supporting your local side, unless you're there every week, you're not made welcome. Whereas actually, if you're putting stuff on that makes it a welcoming family experience, maybe it does become more of a habit on a Friday night. It doesn't have to be Yeah, I think hardcore.
I guess, you know, do we quite have the facilities everywhere around the country to create that atmosphere? I think, again, I think one of the problems that, that the league faces is there's an inequality there between certain clubs, and certain clubs are able to offer certain things that others wouldn't be able to offer. I would take it, I mean, I know you had someone on the Saturday panel from Bohemians before who, okay, they're in a relegation battle last season, but I just know from going to games there that their crowds have gone up, the atmosphere around the ground has gone up, they've got their act together in the community. When in fact when Bows were winning leagues 10 or 11 years ago, I didn't feel the same vibe around the club that you would get now. It's clearly something that they've worked at, and I mean the crowds were up around the league last year generally. I think the fact that Cork were doing very well, they were almost the main contributor in that, but I think clubs slowly but surely have become more proactive in that department. I would be loath to say that the penny has dropped completely, and I think facilities remains to me obstacle to the kind of stuff that you were talking about there. If, you know, the basketball's indoors, you know, like there's certain things that people aren't going to face that you might encounter at a League of Ireland ground. But I mean, you do have Talla and Turner's Cross in places. You go to Turner's Cross on a Friday night and it's great. Like after the games at Turner's Cross, if you want to go and feel hope about the future of the league, you know, after the games, the Cork players are coming out and there's like hundreds of kids there waiting to get autographs. The likes of Kev wouldn't be giving
them away, but
some players there, would, and that's something.
They're
you
good
can,
lads,
but that's something. But that's something you can feel, like you know, that there's an identity there. And I mean, you do have to start them young. Ultimately, you want to appeal to the 30 somethings or people listening who've never gone, and you hope it. But realistically, where it starts is at the younger age groups, and they have to foster that community identity. And there's progress, but there's still a hell of a way to go in that regard.
Is it Cork against Dundalk again?
I personally think so, although Shamrock Rovers are knocking on the door, and I mean they start off with, you know, away to Bowes tomorrow night, Dublin Derby, and then home against Dundalk next week. So I mean, within 2 weeks' time, we could be talking about Rovers as title contenders, and certainly it is the club that has some of the players that might come onto our radar in a different sort of scope, you know, in the next couple of years, in the sense that they have Trevor Clark there, they have Aaron Bulger, a young midfielder there. They've Graham Burke, who come home from England, some really young, talented players who, if they sort of got it together, they could go very well. They'd also probably have to face interest in the summer, which is the other thing. Mm. But I still think that Cork and Dundalk are that bit further ahead in their evolution. Cork in particular have just tweaked things a bit since losing Sean Maguire. They, you know, over the winter, they've strengthened from other clubs in the league. And what we have seen is that Cork, Dundalk and Shamrock Rovers are now able to go and pluck players from other clubs. They even paid transfer fees last summer, which is a bit unusual here. You know, Cork to sign Kieran Sadlier from Sligo, who's going to be a big player this year, and someone again.
I'm not afraid to talk him up either.
No, they know he's got all the ability in the world. What's noticeable about the comments from the Cork camp is that they're saying he's got everything right in the attacking sense. He just needs to work maybe on going the other way. But this is a guy who's English born, Irish qualified, came over to Ireland to sort of get his career going again, having been at West Ham and Peterborough, and did well at Sligo. But he's gone to Cork, and by all accounts, he's gone down that route over the winter of the gym, strengthening up, having himself physically ready to go, and he's very good friends with Sean Maguire. They were at West Ham together. So, I mean, they overlapped for 2 or 3 weeks and they were delighted to be back together for that short space of time. But in Sean Maguire, I think Sadlier has the role model to follow. You can see Maguire tweeting him and speaking about him. They know he's got the ability and he's effectively trying to go on that.
It's important that Cork did replace the goals, didn't they, from Sean Maguire. They didn't seem to find the net consistently enough after he left. Of course, he'd done so well anyway.
No, and that is still a question mark. You know, they've brought a guy, Graham Cummins, back from St Johnston. I mean, he was involved at first team level there. Ironically enough, possibly replaced by Dave McMillan. I mean, one of his last games for St Johnston, he scored at Ibrox. Like, he was around the first team squad there. He's 30. He's an ex-Cork City player, and he's come back and he's going to be up front, but he's a different type of player. And they've signed Barry McNamee from Derry City, who's a very creative sort of number 10 type player, and they've got Carl Shepherd still there, but it's a different front four to what they had last year. But I mean, I watched them, you know, played Dundalk in the second half. It was a weakened Dundalk side, but they still scored 4 goals in the second half in that President's Cup game, and you're thinking, yeah, you know, this team could be pretty good. So
what's going on with Dundalk? because they feel like a team sort of stuck in limbo, maybe because of the money that's arrived in the club, that League of Ireland teams sense that they have money, they're not going to let their players go to them cheaply. They're looking for fees which Dundalk either can't pay or won't pay. So, as you say, they're looking abroad at younger players to bring in. Have they been able to fully capitalise on that run in the Europa League?
I think it's a fair question. They just kept losing players, and they've lost players at the end of every season, and even last season just gone. I mean, they still lost Patrick McElhenney and Dave McMillan. And going into the best year they had, which was 2016, obviously, I mean, that winter, they lost Richie Towell, they brought in Robbie Benson and Patrick McElhenney, and that was almost pretty much it. So it was a very settled team that had been together for a couple of years that just went there from the start and cracked on. The last two seasons, it feels like at the start of the season, they're still signing players, you know, there's injuries, they're not as settled as Cork are at the moment. But they'd had an okay pre-season up until the Cork game, it must be said. They were away in Spain, they beat FC Seoul, I think the Korean champions apparently played very well in that game, beat a Brentford B team that came over here, and there were some good signs. And I still think, you know, they have the bones of a very good team there, they just maybe don't have that settled unit that Cork have, and they need to start the season well and not lose the distance that they lost last year, because I mean the league was over after, you know, a third of last season, and I don't think it will happen this time, but you can't allow it to happen.
I was surprised when I picked up the Examiner this morning to see Stephen O'Donnell saying that Waterford were the dark horses. What have Waterford been doing over the summer?
Yeah,
or over the winter.
That's the thing. You know, it's ingrained in your head, isn't it?
Inexcusable.
So they were first division champions last year.
Yeah, Waterford got promoted last year, but they were effectively like a professional club in the first division last year, which is unusual. Lee Power, who's a Swindon Town guy, is the owner, but effectively Alan Reynolds is the manager, but Pat Fenden is the director of football and is involved in of the recruitment. And essentially they had a good team already, and they've recruited quite well in the off season. You know, some good players sort of locally. I mean, Izzy Akinade at Bowes, you know, Gavin Holohan.
Gavin was part of my reserve team up at Hull, so
really?
He was very much on the verge of making it at Hull. It was just one of those things, probably had a strong squad at the time.
He's a talented player. I think even here he was at Cork City, and you know, he's a creative player, and they couldn't quite just find a role for him in that Cork team at that time. And he seems to have got his career back going again. And they've signed a few players, you know, with that sort of profile. And they've also Bastien Herry, a guy who was at Limerick last year, a French midfielder. And they've brought in a couple of wildcard guys with contacts that they have. A couple of guys from Holland, a guy who was at Ajax as a teenager, Stanley Adoria, I think his name is, who played at 17 for Ajax first team level. So, and people who've seen them in pre-season seem to have been quite impressed. So there is sometimes a team that comes up, they have that momentum. And in fact, you see it in any league anywhere. In the, you know, you see the Championship this year, Sheffield United or someone comes up and they're used to winning, and they just push on again. And maybe there is that element with Waterford that, I mean, we're talking, a lot of the talk this week is about the games tomorrow night in Dublin. You know, Waterford's first game back, the crowds are good. You know, that the crowd down there could rival anything that happens in Dublin. And in fact, the regional strength of the league is another talking point at the moment as well, that around the country, there's regional bases doing well that maybe weren't doing well 5-6 years ago.
It is the 10-team league, which has a lot of negatives when it's first mooted, and probably last season had a lot of negatives, and I'm sure down in Galway they're not particularly pleased with the change. But now that it's here, it feels as though actually it's going to be a particularly strong league, that you're looking there and that it's hard to see where the real weak link is. Maybe Bray, if the off the field
and Limerick,
and
Limerick have had financial struggles in the off season. Unfortunately, their manager left on the first day of the season, Neil McDonald, who I think, you know, you dealt with Neil before, he left, and certainly there was worries about the finances there. So it's not perfect.
One down, one into a playoff?
One down, one into a playoff, and then there's a sort of a convoluted playoff route for the teams in the first division. But I was never that down in the 10-team idea, because I'm convinced that the way forward is to get the base standard in the Premier Division up. I think we should aspire to every team in the Premier Division being full-time within a couple of years, and it just logically you have a better chance of that with 10 than you do with 12 or, you know, or 14. And there's a certain amount of good players to go around, and I think they've been condensed, you know, into 10 teams now. And I think I would hope that the bar would be set quite high this year. I mean, you'd still be very concerned about the Bray situation and Limerick. But, I mean, if Galway had been in there, maybe instead of Bray, you would have a very strong 10 team with a nice regional spread around the country. And I think these 10 teams, more should be asked of them in terms of ground standards and all the stuff we touched on earlier. I think there comes a point
where... licensing.
You can't just turn a blind eye to stuff and say they'll get it fixed. They'll get that sorted out. If you want to, like John Caulfield said, if you want to go somewhere, then are we just going to go around in the same... you know, the same sort of, we're just changing the structure again, 10 to 12, 12 to 10. The change to 10 matters if there's a standard that comes with it, a new standard that comes with that. And that's what you hope this season brings.
What about my boys in Inchcore, St. Pat's?
I believe you're going to become a St. Pat's fan. Oh. This is the new development of the off-season.
Is Michael Dee a St. Pat's fan now? Is that where
he's everybody.
He goes?
Longford Town, but yeah, I live up that way. So yeah, I'll get to games if I can, yeah.
Yeah, no, that is, we've heard this, he's ready to go on board. He's hitched to several wagons already. Yeah.
If I'm here, that's it.
That is the catch cry of many sort of casual. If I can, I'll get there when I can. But he has spoken about it. You know,
a
statement of intent.
Are they a corporate section of Pat's?
You're such a tool. Honest to God,
there is a director's box of sorts in there. But if you're going to go with Brian Kerr, Brian goes and stands in the Camac on the far side, and he gets properly stuck in. You know, he will be spotted
the
there.
The referee's ears are burning by the end.
Players, whoever it might be. I think we will see him there at some stage. I'm determined it will happen.
I want to play a clip from the Keith Andrews show from a little bit earlier today. So it's live every Thursday lunchtime on facebook.com/offtheball, youtube.com/offtheball, Twitter, Periscope, all of that every Thursday around about 12:30. Kevin Doyle was Keith's special guest today, and they were talking about the stupid little distractions that certainly didn't help in terms of our qualification for the 2014 World Cup.
I look back on it, the monotony in the build-up, I expected that. You know, I expected the weeks together and that doesn't, you know me, I'm happy to sleep in a hotel room during the afternoon and I can get over that side of it. It was just my job and you're get ready for the Euros and this is what it is, this build-up and this spell together. But, you know, the performance, you know, I didn't mind that if we put in the performance. That first game, the Italy game and the Spain game, they were two teams who were playing well at the time. I mean, I think we're under pressure.
Especially
here
Spain.
Anyway. Yeah, we're not, this group is difficult, but we need to put in a performance against Croatia. And we were just, I thought after all that build up and disappointed with my own performance, I'm not talking about not giving out about everyone else, but my own performance was pretty, very average and not what I wanted. And, you know, just looking at the whole thing and as they say, you know, just lots of little things weren't quite right and they all built up to become big things, big issues. I remember, you know, spoke about the day before that game and everyone's trying to rearrange where their girth. Just stupid things that shouldn't be, we shouldn't have ever been thinking about, talking about or complaining about it. It shouldn't have been.
Trying to rearrange what?
Where our girlfriends were staying and wives were staying.
How was that an issue the day before the game?
Because they only arrived the day before the game. So we didn't, the hotel they were in, I remember, was above a lap dancing club or something like that, and all of a sudden
its benefits, yeah. Obviously,
like you're grand. We were getting phone calls the day before. Well, you know, this Kevin or all of us, mine was leaving me alone. I think she was sorting out for herself. But lads were getting a bit of stick about that. But it isn't an issue. It can be dealt with. It's fine.
But it's a needless distraction. That you would imagine the Croatian players didn't have to deal with.
Yeah, it becomes an issue when you're together and stuff is niggling at you when you're together for so long. Everything.
I've said that before about with like we genuinely got on. I mean, it's probably the case in all the Ireland squads you've been in, I presume. But that group really, really got on well. So it's not like you hear the England teams in the past, the egos, the north-south divide. That was never the case with us. But by the end of it, I think we were doing each other's heads in.
Yeah.
that's great stuff, isn't it?
Where were you staying? You were retired.
I was just... No, I was
you heard that there was a few spare rooms suddenly going in. Could have been cheaper.
A few of the players' wives have checked out.
I got the phone call, lads. Go on you go, you go. Yeah, I was down there in a flash. No, I was in Poznan, wasn't I, for the short while when I first got there. Then I was staying in the middle of Gdansk. So it was probably about,
you missed out
about half an hour, wasn't it? 20 minutes, half an hour to Sopot from there, yeah. So I had a couple of nights out in Sopot. I did enjoy myself, I enjoyed the Euros.
Really good stuff from Kevin Doyle. There's a lot of talking about, as he said, it was probably any number of little things that all built up into one giant frustration, including, as he said, the team hotel almost feeling like it was a stag party destination. But when I think back to that, because we stayed in an apartment right across from the team hotel, and we didn't really have any Wi-Fi, but they had perfect Wi-Fi in the team hotel. So we go across there every day for a couple of hours to do all our work, and it was full of supporters, which I get the fans and players, you want to have a relationship. But the players literally couldn't leave the lift. And I remember thinking of one day, I think it was maybe John O'Shea was over talking to his wife and his family. And you would think, he's just come out of the lift. Everybody has the cop on. To just give him 15, 20 minutes. He'll sign a few autographs. He'll get all... Literally, he had to go back up 10 minutes later because not once had he 2 seconds to talk to anybody without somebody wanting a photo.
I suppose we would have always had that, I suppose. We had it in probably in 2002 as well when we were there.
But you wouldn't have that if you were in Dublin. No, like, would supporters be coming into the hotel?
No, not really. Not really. You get the odd one here and there, really. So yeah, and it is madness around the Euro, around the major tournaments. I think that's just the way it is.
I think obviously the results shape the history of it in some ways.
I think that's what it is. Yeah.
I think I remember going to the. I remember before the first game in Poznan, there was like footage of the team coming out of the hotel onto the bus, and I mean it had been 10 years since the last tournament, and you're thinking, this is fantastic, but. I mean, Sopot, I mean, I actually hated Sopot after a while. Like, it was that stag party every night. And I was just thinking, like, you know, we were working there. It was suffocating enough as it was. But for the players, I can only imagine after the couple of weeks that they had together. Because the real problem with that tournament preparation, in many ways, it wasn't just that. It was Italy, Hungary, then Sopot for like, five or six days before it started. They basically had to beg for a day off, I think, at one stage. Yeah. And a lot of factors came together where the novelty of the crowd and everyone being in the hotel is great when you're in good form, maybe, and you're fresh. But when you're getting a bit fatigued with everything that's going on, I can imagine it's just give us some space.
Probably an element of that as well. And I think, again, it was manic in 2002, but when you get a few decent results, then it does change it. Perception
is
changed.
We
were getting on each other's nerves in 2002. We were. That was the case. Mm. But it becomes interesting because you're not getting the results. That's it.
Yeah, if you've got a result against Croatia, suddenly all the fans around the hotel for the first game is... They're talking about it five years on. It's a special moment, and you knew what it meant to play for Ireland.
Yeah.
Whereas otherwise, you're looking back going, Christ, everything was a distraction.
Yeah, but also the fact that, I suppose, and it was touched on in the chat earlier, I mean, half the squad were practically alienated as well because they knew they weren't going to be playing. And, you know, that tournament, even, you know, like we go along as press and you chat to players and I can't wait, really looking forward to the game. But I'll never forget the day after the Spain game, where we went down to so the tournament was over and the players were just sitting out in the training pitch. Everyone just looked miserable. You could just tell that this tournament was now over. They checked out, and that, you know, that I think it was soul destroying for anyone that was around at that point, that this wasn't what a major tournament was supposed to be. Yeah. That was a real unusual vibe, certainly that last 5 or 6 days.
I have just remembered that we had a media game.
We did, yeah.
And Kevin turned up because he was a member of the media and played and ran the show from the middle of midfield. And then the very next day in the Irish Daily Mail. Or was it printed?
No, I think he just emailed. He emailed player ratings.
He gave his player ratings around
every player.
And I remember he and I remember this still. I got like a 5, and he said turned up late. Would have been better off if he hadn't turned up at all.
Yeah, because I got a 4, totally anonymous. So it just goes to show.
I tell you what, as well, you lads have all remembered it as well. That's the best thing. Remember when you give those scores? That's what I did. All those shite scores that you give me over the years. I just did a little bit.
We're all prone to the same problem. Yeah. The player that doesn't talk to you because of some bad rating, you say that's unbelievable. Unbelievably petty, and then you still remember this 5 years later.
Yeah, we got to go to a break, and we're going to get to Graham Hunter. One word, Dan, who's going to win the league?
Dundalk.
Oh, you can take the he's unbiased. He's unbiased.
Narrowly.
All right, very good, Dan. Lots more to come, and plenty of podcasts around the place as well for anybody who wants a little bit more in depth on the League of Ireland. And we will be covering it on our Saturday panel this week. We have Stephen Kenny in studio from Half One, Alan Murphy of Galway United as well amongst our guests, and we'll have plenty more League of Ireland coverage over the coming weeks as well. Up next, though, we're going to be talking to Graham Hunter.
Off the ball. This is News Talk.
Graham Hunter, good evening.
Marv, that's the saddest intro I've ever had.
Sorry, I was told that you were going to be on screen and I can't see you. I was waiting to see your beautiful face and there's no sign of it.
Believe me, baby, it's just like...
Ah, there he is,
when you go to church on a Sunday, just because you can't see me doesn't mean I'm not there and miraculous. But also, listen, how could you do that to me, right? First of all, I'm looking straight at the camera here. Anybody at the Olympia in Dublin last night watching Weller without me? I hate you all. Okay.
Do you know what?
Did you have to rub that in by playing my intro tonight?
I was going to say there, Graeme, JP wouldn't let me go. He's been breaking me balls lately, so I couldn't even get to see him over the last 3 nights.
You and me both, killer.
Honestly.
So he's killed Joy in 2 great men in 1 bad night.
Is Weller a football
like
man?
Bad day at Black Rock, isn't it? Bad day at Black Rock College. You know what I'm saying?
Graeme, is Weller a football man?
Are you kidding, man? Have you seen the front cover of Stanley Road and the little picture of the footballer? I suppose it depends if you categorise Chelsea any longer as a real football club rather than an international sacking conglomerate. But when he used to go down the bridge.
Yeah.
And it goes without saying that much of the passion that inspires his work comes from Pittodrie, but like, I didn't mention that. That's so flaming obvious, eh?
You were speaking to one of Kevin's former teammates today?
Or was I now?
Kevin Phillips?
Yeah, no, listen, Kev gave us a masterclass in finishing. You know my endless curiosity about things less interesting than Kev's life, Kev, that's with you. And so, for example, football fascinates me, and with Kev Phillips up at the Derby training ground, all I really wanted to know was what the art of finishing so well was, what the art of knowing when a goalkeeper's put his weight on the wrong foot, how to slide rule a ball past, how hard he worked at understanding other defenders, how much he had a little picture in his head. So my favourite part of the whole interview was this magic moment where he said, dead straight face, and he meant it too. I asked him about, like, you know, peripheral vision, and he went, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Me and my wife can walk into a local restaurant in my neighbourhood. I walk in, I won't look around, I won't look left or right, sit down, and I'll know everybody in the restaurant. Listen, that's extraterrestrial, man. I love that so much. Probably you boys both have that same power, but I don't.
No, unfortunately. Kev, like you probably do.
The ears like this that you can see now, I can hear all around the world. Right? There's somebody whispering in Los Angeles right now.
When did Cristiano Ronaldo get the art of finishing?
Well, he decided, he was listening to the show one night when you reckoned, temporarily looking correct, that Zidane wasn't going to last the season.
You know, Graeme,
hold on, Nathan. I huffed and puffed and I mounted a defence, and like in all the best crime dramas, the evidence was going your way for 8 weeks, man. I tell you,
I had actually said to them, Graeme, if Zidane is sacked on a Monday, Graeme is not coming on the Monday night. We're saving until the Thursday. I needed that moment.
No, Nathan, I'll take my licks in any situation. But it was a little Petrocelli thing. The camera's cutting to me and beads of sweat, man, and I'm drinking the water too fast. And then Cristiano, like, I don't phone him often, Nathan, eh? So you got to be complimented that. I said, listen, CR7, we call each other CR7 and CR6, although CR6 is an explosive. I said to him, listen, mate, Nathan's going to have me over hot coals if Zidane gets sacked, because you don't pull something out of the bag for me. Look, man, it's been such an odd season. You know, I wrote for ESPN, or not for the Evening Express this morning, that there have been times at which this season Ronaldo's had eye-to-ball coordination that Stevie Wonder would be ashamed of. And there are times when he hasn't really looked as if first touch is there. He's looked bewildered as he's missed the goal frame in a number of different ways. And I swear to you, honestly, genuinely, not purporting to be an expert, but having watched him, watched his development, listened to him, spoken to people who watched him training, Nathan, there was genuinely periods in the season when other things have taken his attention so that when the special things aren't happening, also the basic things weren't working. But what kept you alert was he still broke the all-time record for goals in a group stage in the Champions League. Now, let's be honest about last night. It's CR7. Whatever happens to the ball, whether it's a mole that pops up, whether it's him stamping on the ground, we know it's not a double connection. But that ball flips up as he takes the penalty. Now, all right, a little flip up rather than a roll to the right is better. But I've spoken at length, because it broke our hearts as Scots, to Gary McAllister about the half roll the ball gives at Wembley in 96 as he strikes it. And Gary told me, never mind Seaman saving it and Gazza going up the pitch and scoring that flipping goal, Gary said, listen, as you are planting your foot and you've taken your last look at the keeper, a good taker is looking down at the ball. And he said he sees the half roll and he's thinking, do I step over it? If I glance at it, it's taken. The whole of Wembley's watching. Now, CR7, Ronaldo's in the same position. He's missed two big, big chances. One into Aurelio's face and the other one he skied when he had time to take it, you know, read the Sunday Times and then finish and he's put it over the... So the pressure is there as the ball moves and the penalty's dispatched. And when the goal goes in that makes it 2-1, you know, there's a beautiful move. Ronaldo's movement isn't terrific. The ball comes to him back off Kimpembe. It's up there in the air and somehow or other, that maybe everybody on off the ball's laughing at me, but to knee it home in that situation, yeah. you take that. You know, it's a Doug Rugvey goal, as we used to say at Aberdeen, but you... That instinct to pop that away rather than fluffing or thinking about do I bring it down or whatever. Those two goals sum him up. It's the essence of Nathan, you know. You don't quite know how it's happened that it's 2-1 and that they win 3-1. But bloody hell. And also look at Messi and Ronaldo. Ronaldo hasn't just scored so many more goals than him. He scored more in knockout games. He scored fewer from penalties. If you look at the rivals, his big goal totals are against big rivals. And have you played against him? When you go back to... seriously, Nathan, unless you know the stat, or everybody listening to the show knows the stat, can you believe it took him 26 games for United to score in the Champions League? And then when he left United after 52 Champions League games, I think he'd scored 16 goals. What the hell has happened at Real Madrid? Changing him, changing environment, changing ambition... It's not just the stat of the total he's got right now. It's the acceleration from, I think it's 16 goals to 101 for Real Madrid is one of the most astonishing feats in modern sport.
You know, you spoke there, about that goal they scored the night. I saw it straight away and I could tell what a finish it actually was to adjust and to recognise that the only way he could actually score, not go with his foot but just knee it into the goal. But something you spoke of there, Graeme, was his off-the-field stuff. I know we spoke of his tax troubles and other things that have gone around that and the court case. But what about his own family life now? He's gone from having no children one boy, to having four kids in the last, 18 months, whatever it is. There's a massive change for him off the field now. Has he spoken of this, that this has maybe had to get him thinking differently on how he's preparing himself?
The nearest that anybody around on the Madrid beat gets to understanding anything about his family life is through paparazzi or glossy magazine spreads and him waving to whichever one of the family is up in his private box. He's judicious about how he speaks. It's not like a wall of silence. He's very, you know, Kevin, he's really tactical about when he speaks and what he says. We hear next to nothing from him about his family life, but it's my opinion that's one of the things. And also, I grant it naturally, you know, heavens above, if at that age you're determined to have kids with various different partners, simply to grow a family that means something exceptional to you, then, you know, I suppose if you're sitting at this age with no partner, no family, some of us would be saying, listen, mate, why don't you think about it? Family life is fabulous. It's really important. So good luck to him. Does it affect his form on the pitch or his attitude on the pitch? No, but I believe that the tax, the building of his brand, his film, and his worrying, his constant fretting, which is a real thing for him about, am I or am I not the top paid player in the world? These things have shaved every day a percentage away from him. So is the fact that Morata going away, Hammers going away, meant that it was far less likely that Zidane was going to drop him, rest him. There have been moments this season when he should have been dropped. But I will say this, Kevin, and I think it's important. When the biggest stories came out about he wants to leave, he's going to force a departure, he wants to go to Paris Saint-Germain, he's demanding to be top paid in the world, as soon as that reached overkill and he wasn't playing well, he came out and did a big, big interview with the Chinese media. And in that, he says, he realised that the message that he and his agents have been putting out may not stay, wants a massive rise. He negotiated a settlement with Real Madrid. I'll shut up. I'll not talk about leaving. I won't brief about leaving. I'll talk about staying to the end of my career if we find a mid-path in terms of my salary raise. And I think that was the smartest thing he could do. He'd misjudged the power seat. He wasn't in the power seat. Real Madrid was. There aren't clubs out there who are going to pay a transfer fee and the wages he wanted. And he came to that realisation, knocked all the sulking off the table, did the Chinese interview to prove it. And since then, whatever he's scored, he's probably scored 11 goals in six games.
We have a text in from Paul Graham who says, tell Graham that that neutral colour scheme I can see in the background will be a real asset in the event that he decides to sell his gaff and should ensure a decent resale value.
Nathan, tell Mr. Weller, right, you can't call him Paul, okay, that after the opening remarks I made, for you to go for the wound and pour salt in it is cruel beyond belief. And also, you know, there's nothing in neutral about me at all, okay?
It's very true. Briefly before we let you go, John Giles was on earlier talking about Cristiano Ronaldo and saying that there was a genius in Ronaldo being able to really do nothing for an hour and then be the match winner and take the chances when they do come up, that there's something in him that most players, they can't accept not being involved in absolutely everything, where Ronaldo seems to have got to a stage where being the hero, being the match winner is something, and just being that is something he's quite comfortable with. Would that be fair to say about Ronaldo?
I think there's two things. I mean, John's the maestro, and I was listening. I listened to his sort of, because Cristiano wouldn't be John's type of man, wouldn't really be John's type of player, I wouldn't believe.
No.
And therefore, that appreciation nails it. And all I'd add is two tiny layers of detail. Cristiano's battle is always with himself. And he genuinely still wants to be known as not just next year's Ballon d'Or winner, not just better than Messi. He genuinely wants to be believed to be, understood to be, or to have the stats to prove that he's the best of all time. Laugh at him if you want, but we all need our petrol. And more, it wasn't just that he hadn't been involved all that much last night. Just put to the back of your mind, Paris Saint-Germain are winning. It kind of looks like the holders are going to go out in the last 16. That may still happen. He's missed what for him are two sitters. The one-on-one with the keeper where, okay, it's on target, he hits his face, keeper's brave. 9 times out of 10, 3 years ago, Ronaldo finishes that. The one where the ball's robbed and fed to him in the edge of the box and he literally has time to take 3, 4, 5, 6 steps and then score, but he fires it over the bar. Why wasn't that hanging on his mind as much as not having been involved? He's still focused. And when that showtime thing comes, when that Pavlovian bell rings, it'll be in extremis and it'll be when they've played the Champions League hymn at the beginning of the night. I use that phrase Pavlovian over and over and over again. But like when the bell rung and Pavlov's dogs were rabid and hungry and knew they were going to get fed, when that hymn plays, that anthem plays, he changes, baby. Completely changes.
It's like you on a Thursday night when we play Weller.
Listen, I've got a grapefruit manner. It's as sour as shit. Bring no solution.
Oh, I thought we were going to get a song. Graham, brilliant to see you as well as hear from you. As always, we'll talk to you next week.
Listen, baby, it's been lovely for me. You're looking good, boys. You're looking good.
We're trying our best here. We're trying our best.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.